This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
Now, let me just say very simply, and let me be blunt, I don't trust what the administration is telling us about Iraq.
Syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington addressing an anti-war rally recently in Los Angeles.
I don't trust the president when he says, and I quote, that you can't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam when you talk about the war on terror. Mr. President, maybe you can't distinguish between the two, but the rest of us certainly can. Despite all the frantic efforts of the administration, they have not been able to establish a link between Saddam Hussein and September 11th. It's as simple as that. They haven't. I don't trust Don Rumsfeld when he says, yeah, that too, but when he says that the reason it is so urgent to attack Iraq now, when it wasn't over the past decade, is, and I quote, that 3,000 people were killed. Yeah, Mr. Secretary, but they were killed by Mohammed Atta and company, not by Saddam Hussein. I mean, these are simple distinctions that I'm teaching my 11-year-old daughter. And they are distinctions that this administration deliberately avoids. In the same way that they are saying we need to invade Iraq because they terrorized and gassed their own people. But that was like over a decade ago. I mean, what's the point? Is this a kind of delayed reaction? I don't trust a president who cannot handle complexity.
Syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington. Thanks to KPFK Peace Watch producer Dan Pavlich for providing that segment. Rajiv Kasat is a local artist living in the nation's capital who traveled through South Africa hoping to gain a deeper understanding of life. Kasat dropped by Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington to share his perspectives about war and racism since 9/11. He read the interlude of his book, Trails, accompanied by Jali D on an African hand drum.
The war in Iraq is a result of human neglect. I believe that, unfortunately, the very same people that the United States government claims to be wanting to help are the same people they'll end up killing with these bombs and fighter jets and tanks. I think that at some point we have to realize that there's never been a noble war. There's never been a war that's ever solved the problem. We as people can come to the consciousness and the understanding that there are other ways to deal with the issue.
When racism meets terrorism, Zionism doesn't even matter. Because the U.S. can declare a world order and call their own racism conference. Huh, talk about ego. It's time for us to let ours go. I learned this after I jumped out of a plane in South Africa. No, I didn't walk out. As the plane transcended the clouds and I sat in my seat, I wondered if racism existed at 30,000 feet. Flying first class or second class didn't matter because we were all going to the same place. 30,000 feet above the ground, and I just couldn't get away. People with misconceived notions thinking there was money at the end of the rainbow. Others thinking that by waving flags they would be saved. Flags equaled patriotism and blinded us from the reality of what we did. Instead, countries lived in fear, behind borders, defended by armies. I'm gonna holler. This is what I thought. I better open my eyes soon because I'm gonna hit the ground. No more time for conversation. It seemed the part of the dream still to be lived was 30,000 feet away in a place called Durban. I pulled my parachute. And 3 years later, I'm returning to South Africa. The hope for the world's people did not lie in one singular moment. No, it was only August 23rd, 2001. It's not about color. That's what I told the flight attendant. Color's an excuse. Color's an excuse for the extreme disparities in wealth. But instead of even being able to discuss my view, the United States walks out. Should it surprise me any more than the fact we have been retaliated against? And now that innocent people die in our backyards, we become concerned and pray for the well-being of some over others. I want everyone to live. And my loved ones encompass all life, everywhere in the universe. I have no enemies. And this is what my conscience says as I read signs in front of restaurants and I hear vigils in churches as people pray. God bless America. No, 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 God, if you're listening, please bless the entire world. We need to remember, we share this planet with 6 billion other people. We must remember in God's infinite wisdom, she would bless the whole planet with peace before a small percentage of Earth's inhabitants with victory. We must ask ourselves, is the United States more important than Italy, Brazil, or South Africa? Are the thousands of people starving to death at this moment in Somalia any less deserving of a blessing than Americans? Is it not true that if God only blesses Americans, then Americans will spend the rest of their lives fighting those who God hasn't blessed? But today, certain organisms aren't allowed to live. If they don't change, they'll become extinct. Now we give up certain civil liberties and gain fear. And no matter how much money you've spent on those shoes, they're not going to make you run faster or save you from a nuclear disaster. Now September 11th, 2001 has collided with the past. I think the correct terminology for it is really sad. And my first reaction was to cry. More of my brothers and sisters have died. That my best friend miraculously survived because he decided not to go into work early. Innocent or guilty, it's time to let go because we were all in that plane and we have to wake up. This is what the passengers of Flight 57 told me. As they paid our price, as I slept, they died. And now others will be killed for association. And you want to talk about a crime against humanity? Well, I wanted my government to be present during the World Conference Against Racism. I didn't want to be that child in the playground who, when doesn't get his way, throws a hissy fit and takes his ball home. This is what my government did. They still will not declassify the information that will tell us who killed John F. Kennedy. And maybe the answer to that will clear some of the debris that's lying in the streets of New York City. But for those of you who couldn't attend the World Conference Against Racism, all you could hope is that the people that went in your place could express how you feel. You see, people from certain countries couldn't be there because they didn't have the financial opportunities. Now that means they have no one to tell their problems to because their government representatives won't listen. You see, government is supposed to be more than representative but participatory. But how can it be when the citizens don't even know about the decisions being made, are being fed falsified information and don't even know how to write or read? The truth is governments put everyone's lives in danger because they don't trust the people, and instead they meet in secret. You see, inclusion means we all have a say in determining our fate. But instead, most of the meetings during the World Conference were held in English. And now the same problem that persists in United States schools for those who do not speak English is persisting everywhere. Those who do not speak English are not able to participate or be engaged, which in many cases means succeed. Not participating means exclusion. Exclusion means resentment. And this is how the process begins, or should I say problem, as kids shoot other kids. And no one is quite sure what they are shooting at or why they are being shot. But now I'm babbling. Let me stay on topic. What do you want to know about? Oh, the plane ride? Huh. I read and stared out the window at our miniature blood transportation devices. Each car being a blood cell, each city being a neuron. My plane was hijacked and I didn't even know it. I just sat there as the world continued to blow up and I thought to myself how nice it is to be above the clouds, to be 30,000 feet away from the answer of how. And I thought some statistics might help ground me, but then I realized I would rather be flying. That somewhere down there was reality. Huh, but then I got to sit in a conference room and listen to government delegates from India make a deal with government delegates from Africa. If African countries oppose the term caste in the document, then India will support the language of reparations. And they were trading human rights violations. That's when I decided some things aren't worth my time. You still want to know if Zionism is racism? Well, is terrorism racism? And how will you ever know if you don't come to talk about it? Yeah, I'm talking to my United States government. You walked out of an attempt to bring an end to a world problem. In fact, you didn't attend the other two world conferences, both occurring in Geneva, Switzerland. The first was in 1978 and the second was in 1983. And for a moment I felt sick and nauseous. How can my government do such a thing? The politicians and diplomats have succeeded in ruining it for the rest of us. And I think they're all wrong. And the side I choose to be on is truth. This isn't about Osama bin Laden or George W. Bush. It's about those of us that don't have the courage to speak and think for ourselves. Think for ourselves. Think for yourself.
Twenty-four-year-old Rajiv Kasat is a former youth representative to the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. The segment was produced by Peace Watch producer Reem Kathuda from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. The illusion that this war can successfully take out Saddam Hussein without unleashing widespread chaos, death, environmental destruction, and a guaranteed jihad or holy war against the U.S. is short-sighted, simplistic, egocentric, dangerous, psychologically ignorant, and politically immature. That's a quote from clinical psychologist Diane Perlman. She says the war and peace debate has been reduced to two simplistic tracks of discourse.
There's what you get mostly on TV and CNN, which is, you know, we have to take Saddam Hussein out and the war won't be last that long and it won't be that expensive, and all the energy towards the short-term goals, the immediate goals. And there's a sense of overconfidence in the success and a denial of the potential unintended consequences. And you see this a lot before military maneuvers or certain actions, that the leaders are kind of gripped by a sense of their rightness and whatever the other agendas are in terms of oil and global domination. I think that there's a psyching up of the image of the enemy. There's a lot of invocation of every other sense. Everyone who's for the war, you hear the same litany. Saddam Hussein is evil. He's poisoned his own people. You know, people repeat the same thing over and over again, which is true. But they're gripped by the evilness of the enemy and how we have to take him out. And there's a real avoidance and denial of our sense of vulnerability and long-term thinking. Mm-hmm. And that the people who are against the war are more focused on the unintended consequences, which are due to psychological ignorance. I think that many unintended consequences are predictable or preventable. So we have two different psychological orientations, mm-hmm. say the one for the war and the one against the war. And it seems to me sometimes, you know, the optical illusion where you have, you either see two profiles looking at each other or you see a vase in the middle.
Yes.
So I feel like, you know, one group is seeing one thing and the other group is seeing the other thing and don't understand the other perspective.
Depends on what you bring to the seeing.
Right, and it's almost like literally like the two faces, whether you're looking from a dualistic point of view, us and them, good and evil, right and wrong, or whether you see us all as connected and, you know, in one container. Basically, that our fates are interconnected and that there's another way to address this.
You wrote a recent article in which you attempted to reframe the issues of war and peace, not in sort of left, right, liberal, conservative dimensions, but rather as a question of political maturity.
Right.
In your analysis, what does it mean to be politically immature? And how would you rate the current administration's policies?
Okay. Okay, well, one thing that I've noticed is part of the dualistic thinking, and people are reduced into being right-wing or left-wing or liberal or conservative, and they're usually reduced and dismissed, and their arguments are not heard. And they're also not understood in a deep way. And it occurred to me that it isn't really a matter of life, right and left, but a matter of political maturity. So I was kind of thinking of my knowledge of developmental psychology, and there's scales of moral development and ego development, and that, you know, when you study these scales, you learn how to, say, like, read certain language, discourse, sentence completion tests, and you rate them according to level of maturity. So I would hear these speeches. So, for example, say, well, either you're with us or you're with a terrorist. That's a pretty immature level of thinking. So I started looking at the scales of development and thinking and listening to the comments that people were making. And I've also done some research on moral heroism, courageous souls like the whistleblowers who were on the Time People of the Year. Mm-hmm. And they're also at a higher level of moral development where they transcend their needs.
I kind of want to go back, though. When you say that when the president makes statements like you're either with us or against us, mm-hmm. what about statements made on the other side where many conservatives think that it's politically naive to think that you can fix the situation in Iraq without war?
Okay. Well, that's another comment that Dick Cheney and others have said. Say the dangers of doing nothing far outweigh the dangers of action. And, of course, action means war and violence. So my answer to that is, first of all, that's not true at all, that the dangers of doing nothing are not worse than the dangers of going in. But we're nobody suggesting doing nothing. There are many, many creative things that can be done outside of the realm of military action. We don't have, again, this is a dualistic thinking, either you bomb or do nothing. And if anyone does think of a third option, it's like negotiation, but then they say, well, we can't negotiate with them and it's going to fail, so that gets dismissed. And the whole logic is set up that drives us to war and saying that we have no other choice and that it's necessary. I really object to the idea of a necessary war. No one is asking, what else could we possibly do? What I did was I wrote up some of my own ideas and I sent them out to colleagues and asked them for more ideas, and people sent me back some ideas. So Johan Galtung, who's the director of the Transcend Network of Conflict Transformation, of which I am a member, suggested, first of all, that we appoint a wise people's commission with Nobel laureates like Carter, Gorbachev, and Mandela to assess the goals of the parties. You use tension reduction strategies, call a ceasefire, reduce the opponent's fear. Richard Wendell Fogg, who's the director of the Center for the Study of Conflict, has all kinds of strategies that you do, non-military responses to an attack, even to a nuclear attack. And the first thing you do is you reduce the opponent's fear. You avoid cornering your opponent. When you corner people and you humiliate them, you provoke them to be more dangerous. A lot of this is the psychology of how do you deal with someone who's dangerous. You don't corner them, humiliate them, intimidate them, and threaten them. You make them more dangerous. So you want to have tension reduction as a guiding principle. Hmm. We could indict Saddam Hussein in a war crimes tribunal instead of going in and bombing. We can engage allies on each side. You could send over a plane load of prominent people as a good faith gesture to dialogue with prominent Iraqis. We could send over 200,000 unarmed civilians instead of 200,000 soldiers.
And what might they do?
Well, they could be observers. They could reduce tension. You would not see violence. There's a considerable amount of research on nonviolent unarmed accompaniment in reducing tension. But there, you could do a combination of strategies simultaneously, including economic for the hundreds of billions of dollars we would spend on this. Mm-hmm. We could work out equitable economic arrangements for oil in the region. We could support democratic elements in society. And I don't presume to have all the answers right now, but we spend $400 billion a year on the military. We have extensive education, training, research, investment in this. How much would it cost if we decided that we wanted to do something without violence? What if we put together our best social scientists, our best minds from here and there, and had the same kind of commitment to working something out?
Mm-hmm. I think, however, Dr. Perlman, that part of the agenda here on the part of at least the Bush administration is to remove Saddam Hussein. Is there a suggestion or an approach that you have that would include that in the scenario?
Well, that could be included. I mean, the Wise People's Commission could work on that. People from the region, people who have expertise in the area, but say bombing him isn't the only way to do it.
Diane Perlman is a licensed clinical psychologist, a political psychologist, and co-chair of the Committee on Global Violence and Security for Psychologists for Social Responsibility. She spoke with us from her home outside the Philadelphia area. The Israeli army pulled troops back to the outskirts of Bethlehem today, maintaining a low profile in the biblical city to allow pilgrims to celebrate the Christmas holiday. The sentiment of honoring the holidays with a lull in the violence mirrors the famous 1814 Christmas truce, which inspired folk singer John McCutcheon to write Christmas in the Trenches.
The Christmas truce of 1914, during the heart of the trench warfare, was a totally spontaneous but absolutely dynamic and seductive kind of an event. It began with a group of German soldiers in a lull in the battle starting to sing Christmas carols.
I was lying with my messmate on the cold and rocky ground when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, and the gas cloud rolled no more. Christmas brought us respite from the war.
The British, who were across no man's land from them, recognized this and responded with some carols of their own, and they went back and forth like this for some time until the Germans struck up Stille Nacht, which of course is Silent Night, originally written in German but known throughout the English-speaking world as well, and the Germans and the English found themselves singing the same song in their respective languages. And according to legend, what happened next was one, supposedly a German, ventured out with a truce flag, and it was the power of this particular moment of people realizing that they were more similar than they were different that broke down the required anonymity that war presupposes. And from then on, it was sharing food and cigarettes and sweets and family pictures, and they had a soccer game.
Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. In a flare-lit soccer game, we gave him hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box, and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men.
The truce lasted for just that particular night, but it was quite widespread and repeated itself in some battlefields, and the kind of battlefield discipline broke down when people would simply intentionally shoot over one another's heads. It's a very well-documented fact that they had to move troops around because they simply wouldn't fight against this particular company that was across the no man's land from them. It repeated itself several times over the years of World War I. Interestingly enough, I have found in the years since I wrote this song, that the story resonates through many different conflicts. I've had people who were veterans of World War II, many, many veterans of the Vietnamese conflict that came up to me and said, you know, I found myself in a situation not dissimilar, but sometimes it was I was separated from my company, and I met a VC regular out in the jungle, and we were about to shoot one another and realized how dumb that would be, and that we were both hungry and lost and shared what we had and went away.
Soon daylight stole upon us, and France was France once more. With sad farewells we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sights? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they'd kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone forevermore.
So I think the power in the story, I didn't make the story up, I simply wrote the song, is the fact that it does break down that anonymity. And the final line of the song, in some respects, says it all. The ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end, of the rifle, we're the same. And it's that kind of discovery that veterans find out when they're out there. And that's why I've always felt like it was important for veterans get out of VFW halls and American Legion halls and get into schools and churches and community centers so that they could tell us what war is really like.
Folk singer John McCutcheon, Christmas in the Trenches. Special thanks to producer Scott Gurian for production of that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA and Tom Gomez. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at PacificaArchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening. Here's to a happy and peaceful holiday season to us all.